Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 282. It's titled, A Shot in the Dark, Designer Jeans and the AIDS Vaccine. This is being recorded on March 10th of the year 2001. We're going to begin this discussion of biotechnology, biological warfare, possibly genocide, and possibly just stupid carelessness, which could result in genocide or something approximating that. We're going to begin this with review of an article or a story that we talked about in an earlier broadcast. That broadcast being For the Record program number 132 from January of 1999, we talked about a projection by British medical authorities that genetically engineered so-called designer biological weapons could become a reality in the near future. We're going to review that particular story. This, however, is from an ABC News Science discussion of this particular story from the ABC News website. This was emailed to me by a listener, and research credit on this particular version of the story goes to a listener. This is a Reuters story, copyright 1999. It's from January 21st, Dateline London. Its headline, No Longer Science Fiction. Subtitled, Racially Targeted Weapons May Become Reality Soon. It reads in part as follows. Biological and genetic weapons designed to kill specific ethnic or racial groups are no longer the stuff of science fiction, British researchers warn today. A designer plague that would kill only Serbs, or a toxin engineered to affect Israelis or Kurds, does not exist yet, but advances in biotechnology and the mapping of all human genes could be misused to develop lethal weapons within 5 to 10 years. Dr. Vivian Nathanson, the head of health policy research at the British Medical Association, said genetic information is already being used to enhance biological weapons. Quote, It would be a tragedy if in 10 years' time the world faces the reality of genetically engineered and possibly genetically targeted weapons, unquote. She told a news conference to launch a new book entitled, quote, Biotechnology Weapons and Humanity, unquote. It is not technology and information that is available today, but it is becoming increasingly available. We do not have a window of opportunity before weapons of that type are manufactured to make sure we have effective measures of prevention, unquote. The book by Professor Malcolm Dando, D-A-N-D-O, of the Department of Peace Studies at the University of Bradford in Northern England, paints a terrifying picture of the power of biological weapons. The release of 220 pounds of anthrax spores from canisters planted in a major city could wipe out up to 3 million people. The book traces the history of the development and use of biological weapons and warns that scientific knowledge has been exploited in the past and is likely to be misused in the future unless international action is taken. Quote, We believe biological weapons will become an increasing weapon in terrorist activity, unquote, said Nathanson, again quoting, An ethnically targeted weapon becomes more of a reality, unquote. The designer weapon works on a similar principle to gene therapy, but instead of replacing faulty genes that don't work, it exploits genetic variations to target its victims. For example, microorganisms could be genetically engineered to attack known receptor sites on the cell membrane, or viruses could be targeted at specific DNA sequences inside cells. And in addition to the possibility of genetically engineered bioweapons produced by or used by terrorists, also fascist elements within a given government structure, perhaps even allied with terrorist elements or the fifth column of what I call the Underground Reich, could do something similar. Bear in mind the numerous broadcasts that I've done available from Spitfire dealing with AIDS as a probable genetically engineered biological weapon. And consider in that context also the following. Consider this in the context of the Reuters story from roughly 2 years ago. This is from the Financial Times of London of Friday, March 9th of the year 2001. This article is by Victoria Griffin in Boston. It's headlined, FDA paves the way for first, quote, ethnic, unquote, drug, and it reads in part as follows. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has issued an approvability, unquote, letter for a heart failure drug that is designed specifically for black people, the agency's first formal recognition that different ethnic groups require different medications. The letter that paves the way for the clearance of BIDIL, a heart failure product made by the small, privately held U.S. biotechnology company, Nitromed. the drug would be marketed only to African Americans. Researchers have long known that certain ethnic groups are more likely to contract some diseases than others, skipping down. Illnesses that seem identical in terms of symptoms, breast cancer or stroke, for instance, may be a group of diseases with distinct genetic pathways. This would help explain blacks' far higher mortality rates for a host of conditions, including diabetes, cancer, and stroke. And there may be a lot of reasons for that, including stress, which exacerbates any disease, and that comes with socially inferior positions in society, or the fact that they simply have access to poor medical care. Skipping down again, pharmacogenomics, or individualized medicine, is a main goal of the genomics revolutions. Tailoring medications to specific ethnic groups is an important first step. Consider that in the context also of genetically engineered biological weapons. What could be good for the goose may not be so good for the gander, so to speak, and I think the possibilities of misuse of that or of the accidental mutation of some sort of genetic engineering concept is one not to be lightly dismissed, and it is a matter of public record when considering things such as the best-selling racist book, The Bell Curve, involving research done by the Pioneer Fund, a eugenics group that backed the racial legislation of Adolf Hitler. I think one should not dismiss the possibility that such genetically engineered or ethno-specific medicines could become ethno-specific biological weapons and weapons of genocide. Consider in that context also the following. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from The New Scientist, and this was taken from The New Scientist's website at www.newscientist.com/dailynews. This article is from January 10th of the year 2001. It's headlined, Killer Virus, an Engineered Mouse Virus Leaves Us One Step Away from the Ultimate Bioweapon. It reads in part, and by the way, we dealt with this story first in For the Record program 269. A virus that kills every one of its victims by wiping out part of their immune system has been accidentally created by an Australian research team. The virus, a modified mousepox, does not affect humans but is closely related to smallpox, raising fears that the technology could be used in biowarfare. The discovery highlights a growing problem. How do you stop terrorists from taking legitimate research and adapting it for their own nefarious purposes? The Australian researchers had no intention of producing a killer virus, skipping down. Ron Jackson of CSIRO's Wildlife Division and Ian Ramshaw at the Australian National University, both in Canberra, inserted into a mousepox virus a gene that creates large amounts of interleukin-4. IL-4 is a molecule that occurs naturally in the body. Skipping down. The researchers added the gene for IL-4 to boost antibody production. The surprise was that it totally suppressed the cell-mediated response, the arm of the immune system that combats viral infection. Mousepox normally causes only mild symptoms in the type of mice used in the study, but with the IL-4 gene added, it wiped out all the animals in 9 days. Again, quoting, it would be safe to assume that if some idiot did put human IL-4 into human smallpox, it increased the lethality quite dramatically, unquote, says Jackson. Again, quoting, seeing the consequences of what happened to the mice, I wouldn't be the one who'd want to do the experiment, unquote. To make matters worse, the engineered virus also appears unnaturally resistant to attempts to vaccinate the mice. A vaccine that would normally protect mouse strains that are susceptible to the virus only worked in half the mice exposed to the killer version. Quote, it's surprising how very, very bad the virus is, says Ann Hill, a vaccine researcher from Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland. If bioterrorists created a human version of the virus, vaccination programs would be of limited use. Now, that's something to consider very carefully. Consider also the following. This is from Foreign Affairs Magazine's issue of January and February of the year 2001. This article is entitled The Nightmare of Bioterrorism. It's authored by Laurie Garrett, and of the smallpox vaccine and the issue of smallpox in the world. Bear in mind that the mousepox virus is very similar to the smallpox virus, and researchers who did that terrifying research that resulted in what was called the ultimate biowarfare weapon, they said it might be very easily applied to the smallpox virus. Now, again, consider the following article, again, The Nightmare of Bioterrorism by Laurie Garrett from Foreign Affairs Magazine of January and February of 2001. We read, skipping down, were a terrorist to disperse the smallpox virus, for example, populations that were once universally vaccinated would now be horribly vulnerable. Today, the U.S. government stows only about 15.4 million doses of the smallpox vaccine, enough for less than 7% of the American population. The World Health Organization, or WHO, keeps another 500,000 doses in the Netherlands, and other national stockpiles total about 60 million more doses of varying quality and potency. If the smallpox virus were released today, the majority of the world's population would be defenseless, and given the virus's 30% kill rate, nearly 2 billion people could die. It'd be a whole lot more than that if it was enhanced, like the mousepox virus. Skipping down, the world is thus completely vulnerable to a smallpox attack. The last time a mass emergency vaccination took place in the United States was 1947, when a traveler from Mexico spread smallpox to New York City. Vaccines were then readily available, and 6.35 million New Yorkers were immunized in less than 4 weeks. In 1961, a similar vaccination campaign was administered following a smallpox outbreak in England. 5.5 million people were immunized in a month's time. A decade later, smallpox cases in Yugoslavia prompted the rapid vaccination of 20 million people in that country. Were a smallpox crisis to emerge today, none of these efforts could be repeated. Even if large stockpiles of the smallpox vaccine could be collected immediately, they would be of limited value for two reasons. Only several days after infection would individuals develop recognizable symptoms, by which time even millions would have been exposed, and only several days or weeks after vaccination would individuals develop sufficient antibodies to stave off infection. So note again, the vulnerability of people to the world to a smallpox terrorist attack, and a genetically engineered version of same might be altogether feasible. And it would not necessarily just be available to, quote, terrorists, unquote, but to fascist elements, perhaps associated with the underground Reich within various governments or medical establishments, perhaps even our own. Consider in that context the following. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, March 9th of the year 2001. This is an AP story by Paul Reeser, R-E-C-E-R. It's headlined, AIDS Vaccine Shows Promise in Monkey Experiments. It's Dateline Washington and reads in part as follows. In a study giving new evidence that AIDS can be controlled by vaccine, inoculated monkeys stayed healthy despite exposure to high levels of virus, researchers say. The new vaccine is being fast-tracked toward human testing. In a report appearing today in the journal Science, researchers said the vaccine uses a 1-2-3 punch with two shots to prime the immune system to resist the AIDS virus and a final shot with a modified pox virus to boost protection. The first two shots use a vaccine containing DNA for three proteins like those found in the AIDS virus. These proteins create a memory that prompts the immune system to attack when the proteins are later detected, said Harriet Robinson, senior author of the study. Now guess what the modified pox virus is. Continuing, the booster shot uses a modified smallpox vaccine with the three HIV proteins added. This intensifies the immune system's response against the AIDS virus proteins, she said. Well, again, I have two concerns here, real bad and much worse. One is real bad, which is that there might, given the mutagenic nature of microorganisms, or given the mutability of microorganisms, that they might evolve and that something unforeseen could take place. And given the very disturbing evidence discussed in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire that AIDS stems from a genetically engineered organism that was distributed through the hepatitis B vaccine produced by the Merck Company, the possibility of using perhaps ethno-specific biological weapons and perhaps a modified smallpox virus in combination with that vaccine is not one to be too readily cast aside. In that context also, consider the concept of gene therapy and also an experimental vaccine being developed for AIDS by the aforementioned Merck Company. The following is excerpted from For the Record program number 212, and this deals with the Serpent's Walk scenario that presented in the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk.
In numerous programs, including For the Record segments 198 and 199, we've dealt with the SV40 or simian virus 40. That's a cancer-causing monkey virus that infected the original polio vaccine and has also infected other vaccines. We spoke about this in connection with Ed Haslam, the heroic author of the vitally important recent book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. In For the Record program 198, we visited with Ed Haslam and discussed a consummately important article from the Atlantic Monthly's issue of February of the year 2000. This article is headlined, or entitled, I should say, The Virus and the Vaccine, subtitled, authored, I should say, by Debbie Bookchin, B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, and Jim Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R. In this article, is about the SV40, a cancer-causing monkey virus, which again has contaminated numerous vaccines, and the article is the focal point of the discussion of 198, the major focal point anyway, of the discussion in For the Record program 198, an interview with Ed Haslam, and also the focal point of For the Record program 199, a reading of this article. The Atlantic Monthly's website has this article on it. I believe, acting from memory, that is at Atlantic Monthly, atlanticmonthly.com, but you can certainly look it up on the Internet. Now, in this article, there is discussion of the SV40, and specifically Michele Carbone's work on SV40. He's a brilliant and heroic Italian researcher who has, in many ways, led the medical community's inquiries into the SV40. He has been actively frustrated in his efforts by elements of the National Cancer Institute and the Center for Disease Control. Of the SV40, Michele Carbone says in this particular article, skipping down, SV40 is the smallest perfect war machine ever, unquote, Carbone murmurs, again quoting, he's so small, but he's got everything he needs, unquote. Skipping down, the virus consists of six proteins, three of which make up the 20-sided triangular scaffolding that is the virus's protein skin. But one of the remaining proteins, called large T antigen for tumor antigen, unquote, is, according to Carbone, the most oncogenic protein ever discovered. It is unique, he says, in its ability to cause cancer when it is set loose inside a cell. In 1997, in Nature Medicine, Carbone published the first in a series of papers that outlined how large T antigen blocks crucial tumor-suppressing pathways in human mesothelial cells. Whenever a cell begins to divide in the process known as mitosis, a small number of quality control agents goes to work. Running up and down the cell's DNA, these genes and proteins work together to scrutinize the DNA's integrity. If at any stage of cell division they detect DNA abnormalities, they cannot be repaired. If at any stage of cell division they detect DNA abnormalities that cannot be repaired, mitosis is halted, and the cell undergoes apoptosis, or cellular suicide. The principal in this elaborate regulatory dance is a gene called P53. Arnold Levine, the president of the Rockefeller University in New York and the discoverer of P53, says that 60% of all cancers involve some sort of P53 damage, mutation, or inactivation. Again, quoting, the P53 gene is central to human cancers, unquote, he says, describing it as, again quoting, the first line of defense against cancer formation, unquote. I would note, as we looked at in For the Record programs 198 and 199, deactivating the P53 gene is just one of the ways in which large T antigen, the most carcinogenic protein ever discovered, or oncogenic protein ever discovered, causes cancer. And again, note that one of the central ways it operates is by decommissioning the P53 gene, which guards against chromosomal damage during cellular reproduction. And according to Arnold Levine, who discovered the gene, it figures in 60% damage to the P53 gene, or abnormalities in it, figures in 60% of cancers. Now, again, let me stress emphatically that this program is speculative in nature. Let me also reinforce something I've stressed in the past. I am not a medical or scientific or biotech expert. Nonetheless, I can think and I can add two and two and come up with four. And I find a number of things very disturbing about an article that I read the day after I recorded For the Record programs 198 and 199. Now, bear in mind, in the supposedly fictional book Serpent's Walk, which I believe to be a blueprint for the future, the technique of piggybacking genetically engineered and highly toxic microorganisms onto the back of viruses was discussed, and that figures in the biowar scenario that ultimately leads to the declaration of martial law and the coming to power of the Party of Humankind, the underground Reich's front group in that book. Bear in mind that that piggybacking is one of the elements that figures, obviously, in that biowarfare attack. The following article is from the San Francisco Chronicle's Business and Technology section from Monday, March 6th of the year 2000. This is an article by Tom Abate, A-B-A-T-E or Abate, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. It's headlined, "A Thank You to the Volunteers Who Step Up for Clinical Trials," subtitled, "Experimental Trials Offer Last Chance When Other Treatments Fail." Bear in mind what Michele Carbone talked about with the SV-40 being the smallest perfect war machine ever. I wonder whether perhaps there was more truth to that than he really understood at the time. I would also note in this context that SV-40 can be passed through sexual contact. It's present in semen. It also can be apparently passed from mothers to their children, perhaps through breast milk or perhaps in utero somehow. I would also note that it appears to be behind, among other cancers, an epidemic of soft tissue cancers, including lymphoma and cancers of the breast and prostate. The connection between semen in the prostate and breast milk and or mother's milk in the breast, obviously, need not be elaborated on under the circumstances. I would also note this following element in the Tom Abate article. I remember that, and this, by the way, is to a certain extent peripheral, but is interesting to contemplate. We're going to get to the main aspect of this article. "I remember the day my friend Joanne told me she had breast cancer. She was chopping carrots in her kitchen when she mentioned it matter-of-factly, brushing the carrots off the cutting board into the salad. That was years ago. Doctors treated her cancer aggressively, and thankfully it hasn't returned. My mother, mother-in-law, and several close friends could tell the same story." One wonders how many people have either caught this from someone that they've had sexual relations with, or perhaps from their mother or somebody else. It again, is a highly communicative virus. And the main part of this article, that again is kind of peripheral, perhaps even apocryphal, but one of the things that caught my attention in reading this article was a discussion of the P53 gene, and if one, say, were the underground Reich, and if one wished to decimate the population of the United States, one wouldn't necessarily have to do it with a very fast-acting genetically engineered organism. If one, for example, filled the environment with very potent carcinogens and then were to inactivate the body's defenses against cancer, ultimately the immune system, which has many ways of guarding against cancer, many of those undermined, as we looked at in For the Record programs 198 and 199, by SV40 and the large T antigen, then one could effect the sort of decimation of the population that would ultimately not only reduce the United States bring the United States to its knees, but could ultimately lead to the Serpent's Walk scenario, albeit in a much, much slower fashion. Again, I'm not suggesting that Serpent's Walk is to be taken absolutely literally in every respect, but I do think it's a blueprint. Skipping down, there is discussion of the P53 gene in this article, and in addition to the SV40, the P53 gene is inactivated, at least for a period of time, by the adenovirus which causes the common cold. And apparently, the adenovirus is now the focal point of genetic engineering. Reading from the Chronicle again of Monday, March 6th of the year 2000, Frank McCormick, a biotech researcher since the early days of Cetus Corporation, was toiling away at Chiron in the early 1990s when he had the brainstorm that led him to form Richmond's Onyx. His idea revolved around a gene known as P53. Think of P53 as the judge, jury, and executioner of wayward cells. If a cell begins to mutate and grow in a cancerous fashion, P53 is supposed to kill it. Since the late 1970s, scientists have known that successful cancers somehow manage to inactivate P53. Cancers aren't the only bad actors that turn off this cellular self-destruct system. Since the 1980s, scientists have known that adenovirus, the bug that causes colds, also deactivates P53. When adenovirus invades a cell, it turns off P53, then inserts itself into the cell's DNA. The virus uses the cell's reproductive machinery to produce so many copies of itself that it eventually explodes the cell from the inside out, showering the body with new viral particles to infect other cells. All that was old hat. Well, again, one of the things that this makes me wonder about is if it is possible there is then discussion of using a genetically engineered adenovirus to destroy cancer cells. I wonder if it would be possible perhaps to piggyback or genetically engineer an adenovirus in such a way as to inject material into cells in order to produce cancer, sort of a negative scenario of the one presented here.
And in that context, and also bearing in mind that the Merck company has very strong connections historically to the biological warfare program in this country, and bearing in mind also that an experimental Merck-manufactured hepatitis B vaccine appears to have very possibly have been the vehicle for distributing AIDS, consider the following in the context of that rumination. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, February 22nd of the year 2001. It's an article by Mark Schoofs, S-C-H-O-O-F-S. It's headlined, Merck Starts Human Trials of AIDS Vaccine. Merck & Company has initiated small human trials of a new experimental HIV vaccine that is sparking hope among AIDS scientists. Skipping down. According to those briefed about Merck's research, the company's new vaccine hooks HIV genes onto another virus, the adenovirus. In its natural form, the adenovirus can cause colds in people, but Merck has rendered it defective, making it incapable of causing colds or AIDS. And with the experimental Hep B vaccine by Merck, and with the experience of the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine and the resulting cancer epidemic, the two possibilities that I suggest in connection with all of the articles presented here, bad and worse, bad that something unforeseen could produce a catastrophe, and worse that something deliberately intended could produce a catastrophe, well, I think we should not be complacent. I've alluded to various broadcasts that are being marketed by Spitfire. Spitfire can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, by email at mail@spitfirelist.com. And you can see an annotated and detailed description of For the Record program number 282 on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey is now archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. You can visit their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. That concludes For the Record number 282, Shot in the Dark, Designer Genes and the AIDS Vaccine. It's March 10th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.